All right. Sinking.
In.
You're going to do that? All right. Yeah. Three.
Three.
Two.
Two.
Two. Oh,
gosh.
One.
Fascinating. I don't know how that's not our best sync ever. You're welcome, Aaron. We love
Kathy it. Doesn't give you any prep. She just randomly says three, and everybody has to catch up.
Kathy's like, you're professionals. Yep.
Well, what kind of lead up do you need
sinking
to countdown?
In.
I mean, no, I don't understand.
Kathy, you know, we are older white guys. We'd like it if you just kind of tell us what you're about to do.
So that you can explain
lay
back to me.
No, we'd like to say like, oh, Kathy, are you sure you want to do it that way? That's how we would do it, but...
Welcome to the Fascinating Book Club, a special installment of the Fascinating Podcast. I'm J.R. Forresteros.
I'm Kathy Kong.
I'm Matt Michalotis.
And I'm Clay Morgan.
I like the dramatic pause that Kathy always takes before she says her name. It's beautiful. Lets us know something good is about to come.
You know what that is. That's when we don't have the list of our names in front of us that we've looked at.
It's in the notes.
But then you have to, like, on the fly do the alphabet, Matt. Right, Kathy?
That's right.
It's literally the same order every time. Hilarious.
The Fascinating Book Club is a chance for us to dive deeper into a book we love with the author who created it. And so today we are speaking with author Carolyn Hayes about her new memoir, A Girlhood, A Letter to My Transgender Daughter.
Let's have a moment of silence about that as well.
Mm. That's right, JR. That's right.
This is kind of a new thing we're trying, right? That we're going to do it as a book club instead of a...
Sorry, I can reset that. I thought Clay was going to interview us, like I said.
Oh.
Nope.
I literally had no idea that that had been talked about probably 5 minutes ago. Yeah, let's reset.
You were in that conversation.
You were in the conversation.
I literally did not even
All right.
hear that. There's a lot of distraction in my
okay,
head right
here
now.
We go.
Okay, wait, what?
You're just going to take, you're
you
going to take
it to me,
just a long pause
and then just say like, so, hey, you know, we're trying this book club thing. What did you guys
okay.
think of this book? Like,
okay,
whatever. Just
yeah.
Get us into. Okay. All right, here we go.
But you did great, JR. That was a great intro. So I'm looking forward
to
it.
It really was. It sounded practiced or like pre-written.
I was like,
even.
Wow, he's got a, I was like, this is really well said. And
you
I'm
know,
just sitting there
once,
waiting to hear what was going to happen next.
Once you hit 42, I feel like it's just everything is gravy after that. So
I don't know about you. I'm feeling 42.
Okay, let's do this.
So you're just going to start with the Fascinating Book Club?
I'm going to start it all the way over.
Yeah,
all the way back.
Well, we're starting all the way over. Why? All right. This is for you, Aaron.
Welcome to the Fascinating Book Club, a special installment of the Fascinating Podcast. I'm J.R. Forresteros.
I'm Kathy Kong.
I'm Matt Michalotis.
And I'm Clay Morgan.
The Fascinating Book Club is a chance for us to dive deeper into a book we love with an author who created it. And so today we're speaking with Carolyn Hayes about her new memoir, A Girlhood, A Letter to My Transgender Daughter.
You guys know I love memoir, maybe... as much for sure, maybe more than any other nonfiction form.
More than biography?
Well, autobiography does often trump biography.
More than dinosaur picture books?
I have a serious question. What is the difference between autobiography and memoir? Obviously, they're related.
Oh, no, I didn't say there was a difference between those two. Between autobiography and biography.
No, I'm asking
I
about
I feel like you're memory. Throwing under the bus my question and suggesting that it's not serious when I
yeah,
say...
I was suggesting that.
Rude.
I'm glad you picked up on my subtext.
That's an interesting point. I don't know if there's a much of a distinction that I'm going to come up with off the top of my head.
I will say this. In my mind, and this is completely not based on anything other than anecdotal experience.
It's scale, right?
Yeah, autobiography is like the whole life. Whereas memoir is often like a particular piece of, which again, in this
like,
case, right?
I found trash in my front yard, that kind of memoir.
Correct. If someone were to find trash in their front yard and then get on the Today Show because of that, we would call that a memoir. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Got it.
Yeah. We didn't get
just I just skipped a bunch of memoirs. There was like a season of like 20-something-year-olds, right, writing memoirs. And I was like, seriously? Amazing. I'm so not interested.
My heroin journey that through 23.
That was real hot in the Christian market, especially.
It was.
Oh, it's true.
It really was.
This is the story about how I almost got into college, and then I prayed, and then I did.
Kathy said, I'm going to kiss memoirs goodbye.
Hello.
So let's talk about this one. Just a phenomenal new book from Carolyn Hayes. So I'm curious. Let's start with you, Matt. Since we're doing a little bit of a different format, just kind of talking at a high level, your experience with the book, your perceptions of it. What did you love about it?
Yeah, I think going in, I was a little nervous. Like, just the fact that it says transgender in the title, some expectations come to mind of what the book might be. And my experience was that, like, you're thinking, oh, maybe it's going to be a political book or a lot of heavy kind of philosophical stuff. And it's not that at all. It's very much the story about a specific kid and her specific family. And it's really beautiful. I was really, really moved by it, as you'll see later in the podcast when I start crying, which is totally acceptable, not because I was angry, but just because I was feeling the feels. But yeah, I loved it. Beautiful book. I read it in a day. Highly recommended.
Kathy?
I loved the book. I was a little suspicious for other reasons. I think there was a concern about, was she telling a story that wasn't hers to tell?
Mm.
And though the title, you know, sets it up as the mother's story to her daughter, there's still a little bit of the like, ooh, is that going to be okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear, I think Carolyn recognizes that fully as she entered into this and was writing notes, not knowing what form it would eventually take. I loved the book. Matt, I think you read it in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I read it over 2 days. I stayed awake on an airplane to read part of the book, which says a lot. Usually I get on a plane and can fall asleep before we take off. Really good. Uh-huh. Fall asleep on planes. But I stayed awake and chose to read it and then was like, oh, we are here. So I need to put the book down.
Mm-hmm.
Can't wait for our listeners to hear our conversation with her. What'd you think, JR?
Yeah, I don't have a ton to add. It's a beautiful book. It is so personal. I think it does all of the things that memoir does when it's at its best, and it avoided a lot of the kind of tropey things that annoy me about memoir. I will say also, Carolyn's writing is incredibly poetic, and she weaves all of this different stuff together. She does, which again, she comes as someone who probably had a baseline, I don't want to say indifference towards trans persons, but probably like a baseline, like, yeah, trans rights are good or whatever, but there was no personal investment, right, before she had a kid who became trans. And so didn't know the science, didn't know the religious questions, didn't know the political policy stuff at a deep level. And so the way she weaves all of that stuff together through this creates this really rich tapestry that I think is really a gift, not just for her daughter, but for a lot of other people. Like us, like I feel like I am a better human and am able to love my trans friends better because I read this book. So I have lots of other thoughts, but we really want to quit listening to us and start listening to Carolyn. So let's hop over to our conversation with Carolyn Hayes. We're here with author Carolyn Hayes. Carolyn, welcome to the Fascinating Podcast. It's such an honor to have you on.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you mentioned early in the book that A Girlhood was compiled from writings that you started creating pretty early in your daughter's life. So I'm curious, given that you are such a prolific fiction writer, kind of what that difference was in crafting a memoir and in crafting them from documents, you know, that you had created in many cases, while still, you're still also writing something that functioned as a narrative.
I mean, a couple of things there. I always take notes, you know what I mean? So I'm often, you know, just jotting, because I think it's a good way to, you know, really, well, just remember, you know, but also like to be thankful that some idea has come to you. And also the idea of just writing is kind of also observation, just paying close attention to the world around you. And so I'm always doing that. I was surprised though when I, because sometimes I would write something first and then I would go back and read the notes and realize, oh, that actually isn't exactly how it was. It was interesting to kind of track my memory. And I actually kind of talk about that sometimes in the memoir. I'll write the scene as I remember it, and then I'll go back and say, oh, by the way, you know, the notes actually said this. The other thing just in general was, you know, I was writing fiction, and as much as I was, you know, really obsessed with what I was writing at the time, I knew that the story that I was living through day in and day out was far more urgent and terrifying and beautiful and transcendent, you know, my everyday life than some of the fiction I was writing. So it was strange to be kind of living something that I couldn't tell or couldn't tell yet. I wasn't sure if I'd ever tell it. And then, you know, trying to make up things that were, you know, as gripping.
Carolyn, could you, before we get too deep in, could you just, so the book is called, as we just mentioned, A Girlhood, A Letter to My Transgender Daughter. Could you tell us just a little bit about the book and why it came in? It, you know, it was notes for your daughter at one point, and then it became a book. Like, tell us a little about the book version of this.
Yeah, so I have four kids. You know, the three older, there's a big gap between the three older kids and the fourth. And we were super cocky parents. We're like, we've got this down. We know how to raise kids, you know, just waiting to be humbled. And so then, you know, our fourth kid who was, you know, born, assigned male at birth was, you know, we had two sons already. We know how to raise boys, you know, even better. And so at a very young age, she, though, started to assert that, you know, she was a girl and that God had gotten it wrong. And, you know, that she was arguing with her kids and the kids in pre-K, you know, all of her play was girl. And we were talking to experts and got talking to people who really knew much more about this long before we understood the word transgender or thought to apply it to her. We really were just trying to figure out what was best. And we realized that this is a pretty consistent, persistent, and acute demonstration of her gender identity. And so, you know, we moved to, you know, letting her choose her own clothes, letting her put a braid in her hair, pick a nickname, and pronouns that she wanted, which were clearly she, her pronouns. So there's a lot more to that, obviously, yeah. But, you know, that was what happened. Shortly after that, we got a knock at the door. And so that is what the book is really about. That knock at the door changed our lives forever. And so what happened was that someone had made an anonymous call to the Department of Children and Families accusing us of child abuse for supporting our daughter. And then that started an investigation into us. And so at the time that we were living through it, of course, it was a nightmare. We quickly found out that in a red state where we were living at the time with Republican appointed judges, if our daughter was taken from us, we would go into custody. And there was a chance that we could lose custody of our own child.
Yeah.
So that was terrifying. Of course, like flash forward 10 years, we thought, even as I was writing the book a couple of years ago, I thought, well, hopefully this will be outdated. You know, we won't need this book as much when it comes out. And then, you know, what seemed like really just kind of a tragic, misunderstanding and a lack of education and turned into, you know, the law in Texas. So the, you know, governor of Texas has now signed a law and it's being fought, but signed a law that makes it, you know, policy to investigate parents and start an investigation into them if they are supporting their, any of their trans, if they're supporting a trans child. So it's now a very much a living nightmare for a lot of parents like us, like my family, in Texas.
Yeah, that was it was really chilling, that first chapter with the knock, terrifying thing where it just feels completely out of control. And one of the things I love about your book, which we'll talk more about, I'm sure, it for sure, there's a piece of it that feels like it's about being a family with a transgender member in it. And there's another piece of it that just feels like it's a snapshot of a really loving family. It's like a really beautiful family memoir. I was really moved by it, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't get many of those, right, really, because right. You only get the memoir when things go tragically wrong.
Yep.
And I don't think every happy family is the same. As, you know, I think, you know, happy families are very, very different. And certainly our family, although we were shaken, obviously, and it hit all of our kids in different ways, hit me in different ways. It hurt people in our community. Our larger community felt, I think, really torn by this, really upset by this happening. Because, you know, people liked us. You know, we were trusted. We were members of our, you know, of our church, of our, you know, of our community, our neighborhood, soccer programs, you know, schools. So it really had these big repercussions. But I would say that as a family, it only drew us closer. You know what I mean? We really, I think what all of my kids realized was if one of us was in trouble and we needed to take action, we'd all rally. Yeah. We would all rally around that person, you know, whether there's a kid or a parent or a grandparent, like we were a family that was going to rally.
That's good to know. We're all looking at each other to see who wants to ask the next question. I have 100 questions. So you guys pretty quickly start moving to like solutions for the knock. And that's a big part of the book. And I don't want to give everything away because I was desperately, I told Carolyn this already, but I read it in one day. I started it in the morning. Like I took it with me to go work out while I was like walking the treadmill or whatever. And then I went and sat in my car and read it before I drove home. And it seemed like I had been out working out for a long time. So my wife asked about that. And then she went to tennis and I sat on the couch and I read it longer. And then I finished it that evening. Like it's really, it's really intense, beautiful read. But like, so what do you do in a moment like that when it's possible your child will be taken from you for you trying to do the best thing for your kid? Like, what are some of the solutions that went on the board for like, how are we going to deal with this?
Yeah, there are a lot of practical solutions. You know, I mean, we were lucky in that we, through some just, you know, really beautiful coincidences, kind of little miraculous coincidences, we kind of made our way to people who really knew what to do in this situation. We weren't the first. In fact, it was something that happened often to parents with trans kids. And so we made a safe folder overnight. We got in touch with every single person who could support us, who could write a letter, who knew our family well, a minister. A city commissioner, people we worked with, my mother, you know, just babysitters, anybody who could talk about us as parents, and kind of created this safe folder very, very quickly so that they would know that, you know, we had some, you know, that people thought we were excellent parents, you know, good parents. So that happened very, very quickly. You know, we got also the doctor letter, you know, school, all that stuff. But yeah, I think that on a practical level, that had to happen. On a larger level, we also had to prepare each of the kids for an interview. They had to talk to the investigator, and they all reacted to that in their own very beautiful, sometimes comedic ways in handling that investigator. Because some parts of it were really... the first line is this is not a tragedy, because there are tragedies within, you know, the trans community and really serious issues going on. And this, I just refuse to see this as one of them. And so all of our kids, you know, handled it in their own way. And sometimes it was just, you know, really astonishing what beautiful things kids will say.
Hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Before we jump too far away from the incident of the knock, one of the things that I was really struck by Because it, I mean, again, even though this is all true, it felt, and I don't mean this in a dismissive way, it felt like such a good story. And there were so many stakes, obviously, but one of the things was like, who made the call? You know, who made the call that sicked CPS on your family? Mm-hmm. And obviously, as interested as I was in that question as a reader, how much more were you as the person on the other end of that? And so I thought it was really interesting, and again, trying to avoid spoilers here, how you got to the place of at least having an answer that was satisfying enough for you, even though you will never probably know the truth. And the sentence that you wrote is, even if she'd never ask for forgiveness, I needed someone to forgive.
Yeah.
And again, all of this is happening inside of you as you are doing all of the practical stuff, all of the making sure that my kid and my family are safe, and doing the things that are like requiring you to move states and all of this. Mm-hmm. While all of the practical considerations are happening, large and small, you are also navigating this very overwhelming, difficult interior journey. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what that path to forgiveness for you looked like in a space where you can never maybe confront the person that harmed you and your daughter?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. I think I expected myself to be angrier, and I just didn't have, I wasn't allowed to be angry. You know, I just wasn't allowed to be angry. It wasn't a useful emotion, and everything had to be of use at this moment. Everything had to be helpful in moving forward. And I just didn't get to anger for that person. I really wanted to be able to do education and to explain myself and to, you know, draw that person in. And I needed very much to have some sort of, you know, healing, catharsis, something. But meanwhile, not knowing was paranoia. You know, I mean, it made us terrified all the time. Was this a person, you know, at the kid's school? I wrote lists of, you know, suspects, you know what I mean? Like, was it somebody who was a friend of a friend? I mean, it was very much like this murder mystery kind of thing almost that I was constantly trying to figure out who was it or who was it next to. I mean, I was like, do I have an enemy at work? I mean, it was really made me kind of, you know, a little, you know, yeah, paranoid, very paranoid about the community that we lived in. And it made it much harder to stay too. Not being able to make that connection with the person made it much harder to stay. So I will say that, yeah, I kind of had to, I have a pretty good sense, you know, in the book. I mean, I don't say, cause I never can completely confirm that, but I did, you know, use enough intel and I feel pretty confident that I know who made the call. And then I just had to love her. You know, I just had to love her and really kind of try and figure out what sadness, what fear made her make that call, you know, because obviously she thought she was doing something good. So, okay, what do I do with that?
That's interesting. So that's a really generous position to take. Like you think most likely she thought she was doing a good thing.
Yes.
Kathy, do you think that?
I think almost all villains think they're doing a good thing.
Oh, okay. Well, all right.
Yeah. It goes back to training as a writer.
Yeah.
You know, no one is a villain in their own story.
Yeah.
So she
was doing something noble and beautiful by calling.
Good intentions. Great intentions, I'm sure.
Great intentions. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So even when somebody's doing something really vicious, they're going to like, I'm going to teach you a lesson, right? They're still, they're still a teacher.
Still a teacher. Aw.
And it does point to, in some ways I have to grapple with my own naivete in dealing with, you know, good intentions, people who are well-intentioned who are actually not, but are using that as a tool sometimes.
To do harm.
And then it goes down to the very depth of my faith where I really, really have to, that is my, you know, calling. That is what I have to do. So it was a great spiritual practice for me. I had to, you know, do it.
I'd like to ask about that, Carolyn, because you talked about the paranoia and the allies, and you've talked about the home and the school and work. But you've kind of teed up now the church, and that sounds like that's an important part of your story for sure. So can you walk us through some of navigating that environment, the church environment, as it relates to this story?
Yes. I mean, you know, I was raised Catholic. I'm wired Catholic. So much of the way I see myself as a human being, as a writer, as a mother, is through Catholicism. I mean, there's no way that I could ever kind of separate myself in some, you know, though sometimes I have tried, you know. So it's all wired together. And So I will say that one of the things that's so surprising about having a trans child is that you really don't know who's going to get it, you know, and really support you. And so there were many surprises where I thought, oh, you know, I have to deal with my son's very Christian girlfriend, you know, the mother, very, you know, and feeling like politically we probably couldn't have a conversation and land on the same page. And I was terrified to have to tell her, but I had to tell her for various reasons. And finding her to be, you know, very open and loving, yeah. You know. And then, you know, the priest and the nuns that I had been raised with, the part of the Catholic Church that my parents gravitated to was much more, you know, progressive and liberal. So there was a lot of love and support there. All of that kind of fell apart, you know, when we were looking at Catholic schools for my daughter on the high school level. And then we were talking to the superintendent. And that is a couple chapters of the book are dedicated to that relationship.
Well, that was one of the things I loved in the book, actually, was this idea that there were some pretty conservative people that were incredibly loving toward you and your family. And there were liberal people that you would think, oh, that this will be on the same page, and they would end up doing harm to you and your family, which is not.
Yeah, that was really surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always ready and like braced, fully braced when I'm talking to someone that I feel like is coming from the far right or from, you know, Christian background. And I'm always kind of prepared, but I'm not prepared. I have my guard down a lot of times when I'm talking to somebody who is supposedly progressive and liberal and, you know, based in love and, you know, and so I always get like when that punch kind of swings in, or jab, I should say. Punch is maybe a little too violent, but jab comes at me. I'm usually my guard is down and I'm like, what? What just happened? Yeah. So, and there are all different ways that is done. And especially I think the history between feminists and the, you know, trans community, especially trans women, is long and complex, and still is a place where a lot of harm is being done with, you know, with TERFs, you know, trans exclusionary radical feminists, who again are saying that they're really helping the trans community sometimes and really, really being very damaging, or are concerned about children, you know, and are really, really actually, you know, making a lot harder for trans families. So it is surprising, but when you swing right really hard and you swing left really hard, eventually you bump into each other. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you find, yeah, strange bedfellows, as they say.
One of the things, Carolyn, I really appreciated in your writing and your honesty was how you acknowledged and explained your social location. And that you understood that you were coming at this from a place of privilege and connecting dots while you were in this crisis. And for me, as an Asian American woman reading this, that helped me trust your storytelling. Hmm. And I'm wondering if you could share with listeners even your experience of that, you know, folks on the left and being surprised, that is not a surprise for me. Hmm. And I'm wondering if you can explain how you understand that and your experience, and you write about it. There's that checklist. You're being asked about who you are and who your family is. So I'm wondering if you can help our listeners understand why that's important, how that relates even to feminism.
Yes. I'm writing notes. let's see. Yeah. So the first thing I would say is that when things were at very peak crisis, I got on the phone with an expert who helped families who had gotten a knock at the door, you know, from the Department of Children and Families and were under investigation. And she said, I do not have time to put this politely. You know, I'm going to ask you a series of questions just to assess your risk, you know. And so she went through this series of questions. We're on the phone. She knows nothing about me. I'm a complete stranger. She knows where I live. That's about it. And so the questions were, are you white? And I said, yes. Do you have money? If you need to have lawyers and pay, yes. Are you, you know, what's your education level? Blah, blah, blah. Yes, like a good education. Are you straight? Yes. You know, is anybody in your family trans? No. You know what I mean? Like, it was this whole list of things that we got to go through that was just this list of privileges that made it clear that because we were white, because we were heterosexual, because we'd been married a long time, because we were established in our community, because like even divorce was one of the questions. Like there were so many, because of our socioeconomic status, all of these things, that was good for us. These were all good things. And they made our risk go down in America for our child being taken from our home. So as I was going through the list, I was at the one, it was two people. I was the person getting to say yes, you know, and really like, thank God, yes, I get to, you know, like this is all helping me. And then I was haunted because I could see the people in my mind who did not get to answer yes to that question. I could see them and they were just as good parents as we are, you know, if not better, they were just as invested and in love and, you know, wanting to keep their families together, you know, and I just saw that and I was haunted by the people who didn't get to say all those answers. So yes. And so that from the very start of this, you know, from the very beginning, it was clear to me all my privileges. They were put on a list. They were itemized. Yeah. So that would be one thing. I would say also the civil rights movement, it does get tricky sometimes when, especially when I'm talking to, you know, people of color, the Black community, and I'm talking about how, you know, we've been here before, you know, the civil rights movement, we're talking about the same thing. A lot of times it's like the trans child has to go to the nurse's room. And I talk about, you know, segregated bathrooms, right? Or public accommodations, the trans person being allowed to sit at a counter of a diner, you know, like we're talking about a lot of the same things. And sometimes there's pushback a little bit there, in that community, but you know, John Lewis really was so great in saying it the way I don't have his quote memorized, but it was really like, you know, I'm not going to fight for all of my rights and then leave out this other community, leave this community behind. I didn't work so hard, you know, for us to just cut another community out. So I really do think there's this, you know, all the civil rights movements kind of blend into each other and push each other along, but certainly civil rights for, you know, the Black community in America really, really, really help, you know, with all the fights going forward, you know. Yeah. Okay. And then there was one other question you had in there when it comes from the left, right?
Sure. Yeah. Because I think it's an understanding of progressives or more liberal folks who lean left. And I find over and over my white friends have a certain understanding of what that is supposed to be. Whereas I kind of sit in a place of like, yeah, I don't really trust anybody.
Yeah. So these were, you know, after we moved, I had a friend, she's a psychologist, she's Black, she's raising two biracial kids. And we would have these conversations over and over. You know, I would say, well, you know, about intentions, you know, I can work with good intentions, you know, good intentions. I'd rather have good intentions than bad intentions. She's like, well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't agree. You know, and she would push back. She's like, well, you know, good luck with your good intentions. Just get back to me. Right. You know, and what I learned, especially, you know, in a lot of different settings, it was just well-meaning white ladies took up so much of my time and went nowhere. And so that was something that was hard to learn because I'm a well-meaning white lady. So it's like, wow. Okay. There's all this like cover that goes on. Like they just say, well, I'm sure they didn't mean that.
Right.
I'm sure they didn't mean it the way you took it. Right. Or, remember there are good people in the world, you know, and you're just like, well, obviously they're good people in the world. Like what is going on right now? Why are we, when I talk about one incident with one person is super racist, like why do we, or transphobic in my case, like, yes. You know, I'm telling you this story and we're going to, yes, but they're good people. Well, of course, you know? So, it's this, like, I don't know exactly. I've tried to figure it out. I've tried to, you know, look at it as much as I can, but it's this covering for racism where it's like, it's unbecoming, you know, it's ugly about white people. And so we're like, well, that we want to cover it up. They're part of the cover up. To me, those signs are part of the cover up of racism, transphobia. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
And again, it's like, so the other person, well, we're gaslighting them, right? Yeah. The person who's had the situation, we're gaslighting because we're not acknowledging that something terrible just happened. And they're telling us something terrible just happened. But it's also that we're just, that minimization of it, I guess it also is like this fear, like maybe I did that once. And so I would want somebody to cover for me. Like, and then I'm like, are we all part of the whitey white club where we're all just going, oh, I'm sure they didn't mean it because maybe I did. You know what I mean? Like,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I can't possibly be that kind of white friend. And I bring that up because again, listeners, you do need to read this book. I do think it's so important because, Carolyn, you address what is going on in your family with a clarity that I think is important, that it isn't kind of, you don't write with the fuzziness on the sides. And so I appreciated that you recognized that there was a checklist, that even in a situation where CPS is called and there is a threat to being able to pull your daughter from your home. And I think that is the part that that I, as a woman of color, can say, oh, I trust this author to tell the truth, not only about her daughter, but about herself in telling the story about your family. And so thank you so much for that, because it doesn't often happen, to be honest, in memoirs. I think there is a story that you want to tell and you kind of stick to that lane and make everything else a little fuzzy. And I actually went on Goodreads, you know, just because other authors, we do that, we read. And there was one review and something about, there are a lot of white woman asides. And I thought, okay, I don't think that's a negative thing, actually. I think that's really important to tell the full story of your family and your letter for your daughter. So thank you for that.
Also, like, the godmother, you know, Sylvia Rivera, I mean, that's what she talked about, you know? She talked about, and for Marsha P. Johnson, like, they talked, it was, their identities were all of those
right
things, you know what I mean? And so the way they were treated, the way they walked on the street, there was, the world took shape around their bodies in all of these really layered ways. And so to, you know, raise, especially Sylvia's speech, which it was, is in the book and comes back like as a refrain, to, you know, to give her due, I couldn't ignore the fact that she was talking about, you know, not just gay culture and trans culture, but also white culture. And then also I'm saying all of this, you know, I have to acknowledge the fact that I'm saying all of this is a person who's not trans myself.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that alone makes it tricky. So some people actually don't even like that. I shouldn't have a right to tell this story because I'm not trans myself, but then the story doesn't exist because I'm, you know, my daughter can't write it. Right. You know, right. She wasn't there. This is literally the story that, you know, so it would just be that or nothing. But of course, you know, that's also something that I have to wrestle with on a daily basis. It's not just for the book. I'm raising someone, you know what I mean? So what is my obligation, my responsibility to, you know, do that well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I really want to get back to talking about your engagement with the church, because I think that's something our listeners in particular are really interested in. But before we move away from this question of privilege and the way especially nice white people try to hide behind our niceness, I wondered if we could return to the story of when you did move. You know, you're back in a blue state in the north, and, you know, you're probably in a place of safety. You know, the school is doing a great job by your daughter. And then it comes time to get some healthcare. And at this, again, nice liberal workplace with these. No. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead. No.
No, because the healthcare is still from the previous state.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm still dealing with healthcare that is, yeah.
Rough. But wasn't there an anti-discrimination clause?
Yes.
Wrapped up with the healthcare? Because that's what you were fighting, right?
Yes. Yes. There was a discrimination clause because my employer at the time was, you know, doing everything right.
On paper.
They just couldn't be held accountable.
And so again, for folks who haven't read the book yet, you have insurance, you have an anti-discrimination clause that specifically includes, you know, gender and sexuality, gender identity, and yet you cannot get care for your daughter. And so you went to war against the bureaucracy, you know, the red tape, and what you encountered over and over was nice people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, very, very, very nice people who took tons and tons of time. And at every level, it was just their job to slow me down. Mm. Yeah. So, yes. Yeah, so the actual language in the healthcare itself, which is written up, you know, with input from the state level, was that my daughter couldn't receive care. She's just getting regular care. There's nothing here dramatic. We're not talking about surgery. Surgeries, who knows if and when she will ever get that. People get very upset about that. So, but that, I don't know if and when my daughter will ever have surgeries, but these are just like basic taken care of here. We need to talk to people. We need thoughts. She was refused on psychosexual deviance was the reason why, which, you know, when the person said it to me on the phone, I said, she still believes in Santa. I mean, it's a little early to call, right? yeah, that was the broad stroke. Ooh. Using language from like 1955 or right. 1958. I don't know. So yeah, very disturbing.
It really staggered me that the, how do I want to say this? The advice that you got that was most likely to bear fruit was go start a GoFundMe.
Mm-hmm.
And what you write, this, I underlined this sentence and, you know, like, yeah, I might print it out and make a poster of it. This is not how discrimination is fixed with charity. I think a lot of us fall down when it comes to fighting discrimination because we tend to think in these individualistic ways. This person that I have some kind of relationship to is hurting, so we want to stop their hurting. And I think one of the things that again and again and again struck me throughout the book was how at the same time that you are fiercely battling for your daughter's rights and trying to create a space for her without letting her know that you were doing that work, you know, so that she could just be a kid and just grow and flourish. You also kept like looking to the larger world and saying, but how many other kids need this, you know? And that was one of those spaces where when you said, you know, this we're not going to charity our way to equal rights. I was just really, really bowled over by it.
Right. Well, I certainly wasn't going to ask. I mean, I have a job. I pay my insurance. It's part of my package. I'm certainly not going to ask friends and family of mine who may make less money than I do to chip in for something that I'm already, that's already my due. And which, for kids, there are girls who are not trans, who have issues that needed the exact same medication that my daughter needed at that time. So I wasn't asking for anything that, you know, a non-trans person would have gotten. It was just the reasoning was the problem, not the medication. And
I just want to make sure I understand what you just said. It would be covered if you didn't say my daughter. Is that what you're saying?
No. If there's a certain kind of medication that my daughter needed just to take a pause.
Oh, gotcha, right? Gotcha.
And so that pause medication is often and has been prescribed to girls who are going into puberty too soon, right. and has been prescribed since the mid 80s. It's a very safe medication, right. And has been around for a long time. And again, it's, you know, if the person stops taking it, you know, puberty recommences. So there's nothing, you know, it's all reversible. So if my daughter, you know, if I said it was for this other reason, like precocious puberty, then it would have been fine. But because I said the real reason this is to buy us time, to give her more time to be in this gender, to see if this is good, to see how this feels for her and pause puberty for her. It was denied because she was, you know, for psychosexual deviance.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Wow. There's this story where you find a school, so a Catholic girls' school that you think could be a great fit for your daughter, and you go and meet with them to talk about, is this a possibility? And it seems like a really positive conversation, like, you know, ups and downs, but moving the right direction, maybe. And you're asked to prepare a theological document, basically to say, here's why this would be a good thing. Like looking at the Catholic Church's theological position, here's where there's space for my daughter at this school. Like, can you tell us a little bit about that process and making that document?
Yeah. So I actually went to the superintendent because that's what the school said. And so actually the school that I had gone to was on the list as well, which was a co-ed Catholic school. So we're also talking just about my daughter being able to attend the school that I had attended, you know? So it was a lot of choices on the list. And so we went to the superintendent and we actually were terrified. He was terrified too. So we had this really sweet conversation, you know, really, I mean, he saw a picture of our daughter and he was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, just, you know, he kind of came up with don't ask, don't tell, like just say female in the form, you know, she'd be fine. And I was like, well, that would actually be really dangerous. And it's not really a way to have policy because not all kids, she's not visibly trans, but doesn't work for kids who are visibly trans. And it kind of assumes that she has to be in the closet in order for this to work. And that, you know, she may not choose to be. I mean, you know, my daughter is like, she was teeny tiny, ponytail, big blue eyes, like, you know. So that's why he was like, oh, her. Because in their minds, you know, so many people are making these policies are really seeing a big bruising boy in a dress
with a beard,
you know what I mean, because they with a beard,
yeah. Yeah. they're seeing a man
in a dress, mm-hmm. who for reasons I don't understand wants to assault women in bathrooms, and this is the smartest way he can think to do it,
right.
I don't know. So he was surprised. So that first meeting, although there was, you know, some, you know, obviously we had to do a lot of education. There was, you know, some, you know, like a little transphobia. Da, 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 that's fine. This is new to them. I was willing to meet them where they were. You know, that was fine. And then at the end of the meeting, the superintendent said, hey, you know, if you could make a document of some kind, not knowing I was a writer,
Oh, he has regrets now. Is that what you're saying?
That would be great. And if you could look at our doctrine, like if it could be based on doctrine, that would help, because then I could really take it to faculty. I could take it to our lay faculty as well as priests and nuns who, you know, and I was like, okay, great. Assignment, I accepted. I am I was a good Catholic school student. So I set off with an assignment. Love it. So I find the Vatican's document, which had come out pretty recently, which is about gender theory. Especially for kids and in education. And my first read of the document was like, just like radar for love. You know, I'm just reading it for any moment where I can find some love, some acceptance. And I found a lot of language that was very, very helpful. And I was like, okay, I can work with this document. You know, there was some science in it, which only went as far as it was convenient, you know, but I could work with the science. I know enough about the science of being trans, endocrinology, chromosomes. I mean, I know all this stuff. So I was the brain, neurology, like I could speak with this document. I felt good about it. I wrote the document, sent it to some friends who are, you know, have better theological backgrounds than I do. And like they read it, got some notes, brought it back, sent it to them. And a second meeting was called. And so we're like, yes, you know, we've done it. This is great.
Send them the document ahead of time and they're like, oh, let's meet again.
Yes. So we meet again, and it's very clear right from the jump that our daughter is banned from all Catholic high schools in the diocese. Wow. Very, very clear, right? That is basically what I said right up front. And then the conversation just becomes more and more disturbing, really. You know, basically kind of to the point where, you know, he's really questioning whether my daughter is a child of God. You know, he could not really say the words, your child, you know, because my husband was like, well, don't you have to educate children, you know, because she's a child of God, like we're all children of God. And he equivocated and started to kind of argue, well, yeah, some people do, but, you know, but sometimes some people question whether murderers can really be children of God, and, you know, kind of derailed to all kinds of things that were really, you know, really troubling. Like, oh, but we're not here to talk about all the ills of society, you know? And I was like, okay, well, my daughter's not an ill of society. We're all good here, right? Remember? And we're treading water. And at a certain point I start crying. And my husband knows that I'm not crying because I'm sad. He knows that I'm crying because I'm angry.
Kathy's nodding a lot with a big smile right now.
Yes, people misunderstand women's crying sometimes. But so he did a little bit of talking to buy me some time. And then I got to really talk about what the church was missing out on, what the students in that school were missing out on by not having my daughter living her authentic life side by side with them in that school. And talking about Jesus coming out, mm-hmm. you know, to tell people who he truly is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, so I got to talk about those things in a kind of a fiery, teary speech. But really, again, it was my job in that conversation. I mean, I think he also wanted forgiveness, and I kind of did give him forgiveness at the end of that conversation. But it was also my job in follow-up, to keep that bridge as open as possible, mm-hmm. you know, and to try to still continue to be as loving as possible, because I'm no longer fighting for my own daughter here. But there are trans kids in those schools,
right,
you know,
right. whether they know it or not, right?
Whether they know it or not. Yeah.
I know we need to wrap up, but I wanted to ask, kind of as a follow-up to this, you know, I know it was devastating when you realized that second engagement was not one that was being made in good faith, you know? And I know that's something that queer folks, allies, advocates encounter again and again with LGBTQ rights from religious persons specifically. I know it's something you've encountered on more than one occasion. And you know, a lot of our listeners are in a space where they are navigating what it is to be both deeply religious and also full-throatedly affirming of queer folk. And so I wondered if you had any, I don't know, whatever, advice, encouragement, warning. Like, I just kind of wanted to give you the mic and, you know, you are a person of deep faith and you are an ally who loves your daughter fiercely. All that comes through in the book. And I think we have a lot of folks who are really looking for ways to love well and love loudly And I think you do that really well. And I think the book is a testament to that. So I just kind of wanted to offer you an open space to speak to that however you want.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was actually raised by nuns, you know, when I was young, you know, and they were from St. Francis de Sales. So that was the saint that they, you know, their order. And two of the main things that St. Francis says is all through love, nothing through force. Hmm. All through love, nothing through force. And so that's what we were doing right from the beginning. You know, my partner used to say, you know, he would call certain parents, put your damn pants on.
What does that mean?
Put your damn pants on. It just meant like if they had a kid like ours, they'd be like, go put your damn pants on, you know?
Gotcha.
So that through force, you know? Yeah. And so right from the beginning, we were going to do this with love, all through love. We just weren't going to force. So, and in the parenting circles for trans kids, we always say like, we follow their lead. And sometimes that lead changes. And sometimes, you know, there's all different ways. You don't know the journey you're on, but it's always about following the child's lead. And then the other thing that St. Francis says is be who you are and be that well. And so to me, that's really about, you know, embracing your trans identity or your parenting identity, who you want to be, you know what I mean? That authentic self, and being that well. And so sometimes for me, it's like, you know, my advocate self, you know, being that well, you know, so be who you are and be that well. It also means sometimes I'm scared, you know, and I have to be okay with being scared too. This book is under a pen name. It's not under my name. So I couldn't do that, you know. That was too frightening for me, for my family. It felt like, you know, it was too much of a risk for us in this, especially in this current culture where people are really, you know, can be really violent. And so, but I could write the book. I'm a writer. And so the one thing that I could give to the community was to be who I was and to be that well. And so my thing is on every page, I tried to be a writer and I tried to do it well, to give this story and get it out to people who might need it. So, so to me, those things are so, you know, things I just come back to again and again and again, when I'm angry or when I'm frustrated, it's like, nope, all through love, nothing through force. And when it comes to my daughter, it's like, be who you are and be that well, you know? So those are the two things that have helped me a lot.
That's really beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Appreciate you. Sorry. I just saw a note asking if Kathy wanted to wrap us up, and I was about to jump in and do it.
I'd love
because
it.
I'm a white man. That's assumed everyone wanted to hear from me more, but I guess Kathy.
We need to wrap up, but have you ever gone back to that place of anger?
It's more like jangled. It's more like heart beating jangled. But not pure anger. So I think maybe I have more work to do because I think I probably need to. So no, I mean, I watched Jon Stewart's, the problem with Jon Stewart. He has a thing on with the Arkansas, you know, it's a really great thing on trans kids not being able to get healthcare in Arkansas, that ban. And the whole, you can see his anger, and then you can see him mediate it. And my heart was pounding the entire time I watched it, just pounding out of my chest. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that even is. I don't have a name for that emotion, because it's not really anger, and it's not really fear, and it's not really hope, and it's not really like go get them, and it's all of those things at the same time. So but do you suggest tapping into that anger a little bit here and there, like in a controlled environment?
In controlled environments, whatever that looks like for you. I wonder too, how beautiful it was and how you wrote about, you know, the person who made the call, and how you wrote about that person or how you approach that. And then when I read and listened to you just now talk about the tears when talking with the superintendent, and I know that because I do that. And the message to me and the message I think to women is, well, to all people, don't cry. So you can't actually name the emotion that you're feeling. You and I both know that's that particular type of crying is anger. Yeah. And so we have to tamp it down so that we can catch our breath, so that we can carry on the conversation in a way that makes other people comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so I just ask that as an open-ended question for you and for our listeners to say, some things we can't wrap up in a nice tidy bow. But that was one question I had just kind of lingering for me as I wrestled with, could I approach somebody who had made a call like that with that kind of love and forgiveness and not ever return to anger?
I think one of the things right now that's really, really important is that we hold the people accountable who are stoking the fear mongering and the hatred. Because that woman got her information from somewhere. Mm-hmm. The people in Texas are getting their information from somewhere that it's okay to go after these families. Right. People who are making money off of really, really, really ugly podcasts that are there just to make people feel primal fear and primal anger, right? And so there are all these people who, you know, the woman who was saying all that stuff about, you know, about trans kids and doctors performing operations on trans children, you know, all those lies led to a shutdown of Boston Children's Hospital, where children were getting chemotherapy and, you know, like death threats to doctors who are, you know, so the person who made that call, I don't know, that person was in some ways victimized. They were bombarded by a message by people who are making money.
Yes.
People who are making money to, you know, really
stoke the flames
and fear mongering. So I would like to see the people who are, you know, really the Alex Joneses of the world. Now that, you know, having to pay that for lying and stoking fear and anger and destroying people's lives in the process. So in some ways that does help me see those people as victims, because they're being used mm-hmm. by people who are very cynical and who know exactly what they're doing to get votes, you know what right. I mean? And right. to get money.
Carolyn.
Was that angry enough for you? There's a little fire in there.
There is fire in there.
Good. Kathy's always encouraging incandescent rage if it's pointed the right direction.
Good.
It's helpful. It's helpful.
The book is A Girlhood, A Letter to My Transgender Daughter by Carolyn Hayes. If you are feeling confused about transgender questions, if you are feeling over your head, if you have a loved one who is transgender and you've been wrestling with what to do or how to feel about it, if you already have come to a conclusion one way or another, this book is still for you. It is wise, it's beautiful, it's honest in a way that I think is disarming. And I came to the end of the book and I was like, I love this family. And I would do, you know, I would do anything for these kids and for this family. It's a really beautiful memoir about love and family at the end of the day. And I think anyone listening will find something to enjoy and be challenged by in it. So check it out. And Carolyn, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.